The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, continued on cassette number 10, side 1. The focus of life at Longley was not its magnificent interior, but the terrace behind it. Breakfast would be served on that broad, long expanse of flagstone, as the morning sun slowly burned away the mist from the great meadow and the mountains behind it. In the evenings after dinner, it was on the terrace that guests would sit, watching the mist form and the mountains turn purple in the twilight. Life at Longley was as elegant as its designer. Champagne was her favorite drink, and champagne was served with breakfast. Champagne breakfasts with that incredible view. And always with dessert at dinner, dinners under glittering chandeliers imported from France. Served by her favorite waiter, the most distinguished of the store club's head waiters was a former Prussian cavalryman, Rudolf Kollinger. At Alice's request, Marsh had hired him to be major domo at Longley. Even though, to entice Kollinger to private service, Marsh had had to hire as well not only his wife but his mistress. Witty herself, Alice loved brilliant talk, and at Longley the conversation was as sparkling as the champagne, for she filled the house with politicians and intellectuals, Henry Wallace and Helen Fuller and Walter Lippmann, mixing Potomac and professors in a brilliant weekend salon. She had wanted to create her own world at Longley. She had wanted 1,000 acres, she said, because she didn't want any neighbors in hearing distance, and she had succeeded. Alice Glass was the most elegant woman I ever met, says Altorf, and Longley was the most elegant home I ever stayed in. Arnold Genth, the noted New York Society photographer, who for years came regularly to Longley, first as a guest and then to practice his profession, to spend day after day taking pictures of Alice because, he said, she was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, asked that his ashes be buried at Longley after he died because it was the most beautiful place he had ever seen. Although Alice Glass resembled a Southern belle, an exceptionally tall and lovely Southern belle, her friends knew that appearances were deceiving. She was a free spirit, very independent, in an era when women weren't that way, says her sister Mary Louise. She didn't believe in marriage, and she had refused to marry Marsh, even though she had borne him 2 children. Her sole concession to convention was made to spare the feelings of her parents in Marlin. She wrote them that she had married an English nobleman named Manners. Visitors from Texas would be told that Lord Manners was away in England on business. She would finally announce that he had been killed fighting for the Loyalists in Spain, and would thereby become a respectable widow. And possessed of brains as well as beauty, she did not, like many Southern girls, try to hide the fact that she was as intelligent as the men she was talking to. She expected them to listen to her opinions as she listened to theirs, and if one was reluctant to do so, she could make him regret that reluctance. A concert pianist from New York, who had monopolized the dinner conversation one evening at Longley, was gratified after dinner to hear one of his recordings playing on the terrace phonograph. As he and the other guests sat there listening, however, Alice suddenly walked over and switched off the machine. "That's the nice thing about having someone on a record," she said. "You can turn him off." Men who listened to her opinions found them worth listening to. Wallace liked to try out his more visionary proposals on Alice because, he said, "She seems to be the only person with enough imagination to know what I'm talking about." And men with a more political turn of mind found Alice worth talking politics with. Herman Brown was moved to say she had quite a bit of horse sense for a girl, except that her politics contained what to practical men was a rather unfortunate streak of idealism. Above everything else, says her sister, Alice was an idealist. She admired politicians who, in her view, tried to help people, and detested those who were interested solely in their own advancement, or worse, in using public office to make money. She herself wanted very badly to help people. She had a very particular view of the kind of place the world should be, her sister says, and she was willing to do anything she had to do to make things come out right for people who were in trouble. She was the kind of person who understood very well that she couldn't do much to help. Alice could be very realistic, But she was also the kind of person who wasn't willing not to do anything because she couldn't do it at all. She felt you had to try. It was Alice's idealism, her desire to help people, that first drew her to Lyndon Johnson. In 1937, people in trouble included European Jews. Attending the Salzburg Music Festival that year, she and Charles made a side trip to hear a speech by Adolf Hitler, and thereafter they understood, earlier than most Americans, how serious a threat he was. When she returned home, she began making money available to help Jews who were fleeing Hitler, and she made Longley a way station for these refugees when they arrived in the United States. Guests sat entranced on the long terrace listening to the stories of their escapes. Max Graf, who at the time of his escape had been one of Vienna's leading music critics and a professor at the Vienna Conservatory, told one evening how he had been afraid to make his true feelings known until his last day in Vienna. On that day, however, when he was leaving his office for the last time, his visa and other necessary papers safely in his breast pocket, a colleague had given him the Nazi salute and said, "Heil Hitler!" "Heil Beethoven," Graf had replied. One of these refugees was a promising young conductor from Vienna, 25-year-old Erich Leinsdorf, whom Charles and Alice had met in Europe. Leinsdorf was to recall vividly his first meeting with the towering, immensely rich couple. The impressive man and his consort, she too quite tall and very handsome. After he had completed an engagement with the Metropolitan Opera in 1938, they invited him to spend as much time as I wanted at Longley. A large farm dominated by a magnificent house, a great house with 18 servants, over whom a German butler and his wife, a superlative cook, held sway. Leinsdorf was relaxing there. There was a constant stream of guests, the accents were new, the lavish and easy life with martinis served at 11 in the morning was new, the 18 black servants were new. I just sat goggle-eyed. When, he recalls, he suddenly remembered, with a terrific shock, that he had received no reply to his application submitted months before for an extension of his temporary visa, and that the visa would expire in just 8 days. When he told his hosts his problem, Alice, who had met Johnson only a few times, suggested that Charles have the young congressman from Austin try to help. The next day, a Sunday, Marsh drove Leinsdorf to Washington, and they went to Marsh's suite at the Mayflower, to which Johnson had been summoned. A lanky young man appeared. He treated Charles with the informal courtesy behooving a youngster toward an older man to whom he is in debt. He listened impassively to Leinsdorf's problem, but on Monday telephoned to say he had begun solving it. The Immigration Department had in fact rejected Leinsdorf's application, but, he told the conductor, due to some clerical oversight the rejection had not been mailed, and this oversight had allowed him to obtain what Leinsdorf describes as a welcome breathing space. Leinsdorf recalls Johnson saying that he had exerted his pressure to have the customary phrase, "You have 7 days to leave the United States," changed to, "You have 6 months." The next step, Johnson explained, was to have Leinsdorf's status changed to permanent resident, a change which could be accomplished only if he went abroad and returned as a regular immigrant. Johnson arranged for him to go to Cuba and provided all the necessary documents for his return to the United States. To ensure that there would be no slip-up, he telephoned the United States consul in Havana to make certain that his quota of Austrian immigrants had not yet been exhausted, and that Leinsdorf would be included in it. "It all went like clockwork," Leinsdorf says. Marsh was impressed by Johnson's efficiency. Alice was impressed by something else. The young congressman had brought Leinsdorf's documents to Longley personally, and had brought with him also a letter to the consul in Havana. The letter said, Leinsdorf recalls, no copy has been found, that the United States had a holy mission to provide a peaceful haven for musical geniuses nervously exhausted from persecution and racial bias. It was, he says, a moving piece. It had been written by a member of Johnson's staff, probably the gifted Latimer, but it was Johnson who, without mentioning the fact, read it, in a quiet, eloquent voice, that evening on the terrace. The listeners, including Alice, were moved. As Johnson began coming to Longley more frequently, she was moved by further manifestations of what she considered the same spirit. Those stories about the poverty of the people from whom he came, the people of the Texas Hill Country, those stories told so eloquently that could bring a hush even to a Washington dinner party, were dramatic indeed told in the stillness of a long Lee evening, and so is his determination to help his people, to bring them the dams and federal programs that would change their lives. Alice Glass, who wanted to help people, believed that Lyndon Johnson shared the same desire. She believed that he was unlike the other politicians who came to Long Lee, and whose conversation revealed, before a weekend was over, that their only interest was personal advancement. She believed that she had finally met a politician who was not constantly scheming on behalf of his ambition, a politician whose dreams were for others rather than for himself. Listening to his stories of how he was getting the dams built and the programs implemented, she came to believe, moreover, that he possessed not only the desire but the ability to help people. She told her sister that she felt the young congressman had limitless potential. Recalls Mary Louise, she thought he was a young man who was going to save the world. And she admired also what she considered his indifference, not only to political but to financial advancement. The talk surrounding the immensely wealthy man with whom she lived dealt largely with money, particularly when their guests were close friends like Herman and George Brown. She was just sick of money, 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 her sister says. Johnson, with his seeming total lack of interest in the subject, was a refreshing change. At first, her relationship to Johnson was that of patroness to protege. Although he was 3 years older than she, at the time of the Leinsdorf episode, he was 29, Alice 26. She, so widely traveled and read, so sophisticated in dress and taste, seemed much more worldly than this man from Texas. He fostered this impression. He was always asking her for advice, her sister says. She had such perfect taste in clothes, he said. He wanted to ask her what to do about the way his long, skinny wrists stuck out of his sleeves. She told him that he should have his shirts custom made and should wear French cuffs, so that if attention was drawn to his wrists, they would look elegant rather than awkward. It was at this time that his lifelong fascination with cufflinks began. He told her he didn't like the way he looked in photographs. She noticed that one side of his face, the left, photographed much better than the right. For the rest of his life, he would try to allow only the left side to be seen in photographs. He said he realized he didn't know anything about literature and wanted to learn. She read him poetry. Her favorite was Edna St. Vincent Millay, her sister says. When she read Millay, you could see Alice in the poetry. She tried to improve his table manners. For a while, he even stopped gulping down his food. She proved his patroness, a very useful patroness, even in politics. When Johnson and Herman Brown seemed on a collision course over the condemnation of Brown's real estate, it was she who said to Marsh one night, "Why don't you fix things up between them? Why don't you suggest that they compromise? Give Herman the dam and let Lyndon have the land," thereby suggesting the compromise that ended the threat to Johnson's political career. But the relationship changed. Her cousin, Alice, with whom she had grown up in Marlin, now married to Wellie Hopkins and living in Washington, was her closest friend. Sometime late in 1938 or early in 1939, Alice Glass told her cousin that she and Lyndon were lovers, and had been for some months. When her sister, Mary Louise Glass, arrived in Washington later in 1939 to become one of Marsh's secretaries, Alice told her, too, and Mary Louise would have known anyway. Her offices, first in the Mayflower Hotel and then in the Allies Inn, were right down the hall from the apartments Marsh maintained in those hotels, and she could not help being aware that during Marsh's frequent absences from Washington, Lyndon and Alice spent many afternoons alone together in those apartments. And more, Lyndon and Alice were together at Long Lee. On some of his visits to Long Lee, Johnson came with Lady Bird, but frequently he would come alone. He would leave her on weekends, weekend after weekend, Mary Louise says. Sometimes Charles would be there, and sometimes Charles wouldn't be there. Johnson had become very much at home at the estate. Alone among the guests, he would take off his shirt in the sun on the terrace. He had this very white skin, but he was always sunning, Mary Louise says. would lead the horseplay at the swimming pool with boundless enthusiasm, and when, on the long terrace in the evenings, the far-off mountains vanishing in the purple mist, Alice put records on the phonograph, he was always the first to jump up and dance. Attempting to analyze why Alice was attracted to Lyndon Johnson, the best friend and the sister who were her two confidants say that part of the attraction was idealism, the beliefs and selflessness which he expressed to her, and that part of the attraction was sexual. Marsh, Mary Louise says, was much older than Alice. He had turned 50 in 1937 when Alice was 26, and she says, that was part of the problem. My sister liked men. Moreover, they felt that Johnson, for all his physical awkwardness and social gaucheries, his outsized ears and nose, was a very attractive man because of what Alice Hopkins calls that very beautiful white skin, because of his eyes, which were, she says, very expressive, because of his hands, demonstrating with her own hands how Johnson was always touching, hugging, patting, she says, his hands were very loving, and most of all because of the fierce dynamic energy he exuded. It was, she concludes, his animation that made him good-looking. Whatever the combination of reasons, the attraction, they say, was deep. Lyndon was the love of Alice's life, Mrs. Hopkins says. My sister was mad for Lyndon, absolutely mad for him, Mary Louise says. Alice Glass believed that her passion was reciprocated. According to her intimates, she told them that Johnson and she had discussed marriage. In that era, a divorced man would have been effectively barred from a political career, but she said he had told her that he would get a divorce anyway. He had several job offers as a corporate lobbyist in Washington, and he had, she said, promised to accept one of these. Whether or not this was true, the handful of men and women who were aware of her relationship with Lyndon Johnson, including men and women who were to know Johnson over a long period of time, agree that this relationship was different from other extramarital affairs in which he was to be a participant. His conduct at Longley was striking. One of them, seeing Lyndon and Alice together for the first time, says he could hardly believe his eyes. As Alice sat reading Millay in her quiet, throaty voice, he recalls, Johnson sat silent, not saying a word, just drinking in the beautiful woman with the book in her hands. I don't believe that Lyndon ever held still for listening to poetry from anyone else, he says. And although Johnson generally ate, even at Washington dinner parties, as he had always eaten, scooping up heaping forkfuls of food and cramming them into his wide-open mouth, at Longley he made an effort, the first such effort these men and women had ever seen him make, to eat in a more normal manner. There were, in addition, other telling indications of the strength of Lyndon Johnson's passion for Alice Glass. One is the fact that his love affair with her juts out of the landscape of his life as one of the few episodes in it, and perhaps the only one, that ran counter to his personal ambition. Charles Marsh, as owner of the only district-wide organ of public opinion, was perhaps the individual in Johnson's congressional district most important to his continuation in office. His love affair with Marsh's lover was, in the words of a man familiar with the relationship, taking one hell of a chance. And this man adds, knowing Lyndon, I could hardly believe he was taking a chance like that. It just didn't fit in with the Lyndon Johnson I knew. In my opinion, that was the only time, in Lyndon Johnson's whole life that he was pulled off the course he had set for himself. Johnson, moreover, was silent about the physical side of their relationship. In later years, such delicacy would not be one of his more striking characteristics. Displaying the same coarseness that, at college, had led him to exhibit his penis and call it jumbo, he would show no reticence whatever about the most intimate details of extramarital relationships. His descriptions of his amours were not only exhibitionistic, but boastful. Particularly with cronies, he would seem almost to need to make other men acknowledge his sexual prowess. There was, seemingly, no aspect of an afternoon in bed, not even the most intimate details of a partner's anatomy, that he did not consider grist for his vivid storytelling ability. About the physical aspect of his relationship with Alice Glass, he spoke not at all. About her, he was as reticent as a young man in love. But if his relationship with Alice Glass in some respects didn't fit in with the rest of Lyndon Johnson's life, in other respects it fit in snugly, emphasizing familiar traits. His gift for secrecy, for example, had never been more strikingly displayed. Charles Marsh did not learn of the affair. The Lord of Longleat was deeply in love with the woman for whom he had built it, and was more anxious than ever to marry her. He was asking her and asking her and asking her to marry him, her sister says. But whereas her resistance to the proposal had seemed once to be weakening, now she was adamant. She wouldn't marry Marsh after she met Lyndon, Mary Louise says. She wanted to marry Lyndon. Those of the regulars at Longleat who did know dreaded the day when Marsh would find out. His temper was so monumental, his pride so intense, that these younger people, who were somewhat in awe of him, couldn't imagine what his reaction would be when he discovered the truth. And they felt that discovery was inevitable. They went to great lengths to deceive him, Mary Louise says. It was all so undercover. But sometimes I would be sitting there when the three of them, Charles, Alice, and Lyndon, were together, and I would just be... And here Mary Louise covers her ears with her hands to demonstrate figuratively the way she was inwardly bracing herself for the explosion she was sure must come. But it didn't come. So guardedly did the two lovers act that even Alice's best friend had not known the truth until Alice told her. They were unbelievably discreet, Mrs. Hopkins notes. They were never seen together in public, and when they were together at Longleat, they were so discreet that, she says, no one could have guessed that they were lovers. Until Alice told her, she says, I had seen them both many times at Longleat, and I never knew. Says Mary Louise, nothing showed, nothing at all. What did show, in fact, would have tended to disarm even the most suspicious of men. During his weekends at Longleat, Lyndon Johnson not only displayed his gift for secrecy, he displayed another gift, his capacity for the cultivation of an older man who was important to him, with utter disregard of his true feelings. He was still at Marsh's beck and call. On scores of occasions, like the Sunday on which Marsh brought Leinsdorf to Washington, all Marsh had to do was summon him, and he was there, willing, anxious, eager to be of service. He still agreed fulsomely with Marsh's political analyses and prognostications on world affairs, and was the first to point out that Charles had been right again on some prediction. He still asked Marsh for advice, and was so grateful when Charles gave it that the older man gave more and more. Harold Young, who had watched Johnson play many an older man, felt he had never played one better than he did Charles Marsh. Never, he felt, had Johnson been more humble, more the great flatterer. Marsh had to be away from Washington frequently on business, but these trips did not interrupt the courtship of the older man by the younger, for he continued it by telegram. Wiring Marsh in New York or Chicago or Baltimore to ask for advice? Need visit with you. Wire where can reach you or call me at home tonight. On another occasion, when Johnson was planning to go to Texas, he wrote the publisher, I do hope you will be back this way before we leave. I need the inspiration and stimulant that a couple of hours with you always gives me. Or he would give congratulations to Marsh on his perspicacity. On December 15, 1939, for example, while Marsh was checking on business investments in New York, he received a telegram from Johnson in Washington which stated, Some interesting and rather amusing developments here yesterday which confirmed a prediction you made in August. Marsh's response was all Johnson could have wished. To his telegrams requesting advice came back telegrams giving it. Advice on how to place an ad in country newspapers so that it would receive prominent display, for example. Merely enclose a check for $20. I do not think you will find that any of them will return the change. When Marsh felt that Johnson needed advice in more detail than was feasible for a telegram, an extra rush wire would tell the congressman, Suggest you telephone collect tonight. And sometimes he felt Johnson needed advice in person. Arrive Washington 7:45 Tuesday morning. If plane on time, would be pleased to have breakfast with you, Mayflower Hotel. The advice was on personal as well as political matters, and it reveals not only the paternal feeling Marsh had toward Johnson, but his total ignorance of the relationship between Johnson and Alice. Some of the advice, in view of that relationship, can be read with a certain feeling of irony. On April 9, 1940, during a period when the affair between Lyndon and Alice was at its most torrid, Marsh, who had left Longley the previous evening on a business trip, telegraphed Johnson, "I did not like the way you looked last night. You were not well shaved. Play as much golf as possible with Alice." Marsh became, in fact, more and more fond of the young man he considered his protégé. Sometimes, lonely on his travels around the country, he would be moved to telegraph Johnson his affection. From the Stevens Hotel in Chicago, he wired Johnson on September 16, 1940, "Dear Lyndon, waking up this morning with a great distaste for Midwest senators, I found it more pleasant to write you a note." Marsh's increasing fondness for Johnson disturbed Alice more and more. Her own inclination would have been to reveal the truth to Marsh. She had agreed to wait until the time was ripe, but she felt there was something more dishonorable than she had bargained for in the situation as it was evolving. But Johnson seemed to find it completely feasible to have the relationship he wanted not only with the man's mistress, but with the man. And he proved to be right. His discretion gave him rewards. During the same years in which he was making love to the woman Marsh loved, Marsh was giving him more than advice and affection. He was concerned with Lyndon's financial future because he had noticed that despite his $10,000 per year congressman's salary, Lyndon was always short of cash. The publisher saw that Lyndon was worried about money, and he didn't want Lyndon to worry about money. A great future lay ahead of him, and he should be freed from sordid cares. In 1939, therefore, Marsh took his first step toward placing Johnson on a sounder financial footing. With his gift for making money on a grand scale, he had seen, several years before, how to make it in Austin. Standing on a hill above the small but growing city, he had forecast the direction in which most of its growth would occur, and had promptly purchased large tracts of land there. Now the land was worth considerably more than he had paid for it, but Marsh said he would sell Johnson a 19-acre tract for the same price he had paid, $12,000. "It was a marvelous buy, and we knew it," Lady Bird says. She borrowed the money from her father. Brown and Root chipped in by building a road out to the land and by grading and landscaping it. And for the first time, the Johnsons owned property. The older man helped the younger man not only financially but politically. Although he owned so many newspapers, Marsh's interest in them was financial rather than journalistic. "Charles just had newspapers to make money with them," says Mary Louise Glass, his secretary. Making money did not require editorial quality, and there was no concern with that. On the rare occasions on which some local issue or individual captured Marsh's interest and led him to formulate a position on it, he wanted the position expressed not only on the editorial page, but, without regard to journalistic ethics, in the news columns. And he left no doubt as to the precise nature of the position he wished taken. Making a rare call to the paper's editor, he usually talked only to the business people, Mary Louise says, he would bark unequivocal instructions over the telephone. And after Lyndon Johnson became his protégé, the instructions to Charles E. Green, editor of the Austin American Salesman, often concerned Lyndon Johnson. Marsh would sometimes dictate pro-Johnson editorials and articles himself. His newspapers took one position that was particularly pleasing to Johnson, that no one run against him in the next election. As early as January 1938, an American Statesman editorial, lauding Johnson's work on the LCRA and other projects, said that he ought to be unopposed, and thus freed of the burden of a campaign, so as to give his undivided time to his services in the session that will run almost until primary election day. This theme was echoed by American Statesman reporters. Wrote one in the paper's Town Talk column, "I had a nice visit with Congressman Johnson. He looks tired, but I suppose any man who's done as much for his district in the short time that Johnson has should be tired. Fortunately, I don't think there's anyone in his district foolish enough to announce against him, so that will give him some rest." Potential opponents realized that in 1938, Johnson would have not only overwhelming financial support, but enthusiastic press support. The reaction of the audience, Mary Louise Glass, Welly and Alice Hopkins, and others, to the drama that Mary Louise calls Charles and Alice and Lyndon, being played out before them month after month, against the beautiful setting of Longley, without, of course, the knowledge of one of the three leads, varies from person to person, and their reactions are colored by their attachment to one or another of the participants. An unequivocal opinion is obtainable from another observer, who is asked not to be quoted by name. This observer's opinion is colored by the fact that she had reason to be keenly aware, more keenly aware than the other watchers, of a detail almost never mentioned by the others. The fact that not only the principals, but two little children, of whom Charles Marsh was very fond, and who were very much attached to their father, would be affected by the drama's denouement. Watching Lyndon Johnson fawn over the children's father when he was present, knowing all the time that Johnson was sleeping with their mother when he was absent. Watching Johnson praise the older man to his face, knowing all the time that behind his back he was taking from him the woman he loved. Seeing how unshakably deferential, how utterly humble he was in playing upon Marsh's affections, this observer, a lover of Charles Dickens, was reminded forcefully of a character in David Copperfield, a character who, she felt, lacked only a southern drawl to be Lyndon Johnson in the flesh. "Every time I looked at Lyndon," she says, "I saw a Uriah Heep from Texas." And what of the other person who had a stake in the drama? A person so lightly regarded by the spectators that most of them all but ignore her when they talk of it. Lady Bird Johnson was easy to ignore. Her husband insisted that she wear makeup and high heels, and more she did so. But he could not, except on rare occasions, force her to wear dresses of any but the dullest colors, and her appearance was still drab. Nothing, it seemed, could ease her terrible shyness. During her husband's campaign for Congress, she had been, as always, pleasant and uncomplaining in serving hot meals to him and his aides at all hours of the night. Men who worked for him had come to accept as a matter of course a warm, welcoming smile at the door, no matter when they arrived. But when, occasionally, someone who didn't know her well, raised, however gingerly, the possibility that she herself might campaign, the very suggestion that she might have to face an audience and speak brought such panic to the face of this woman who had once prayed for smallpox so that she wouldn't have to speak at her high school graduation ceremony that the suggestion was always quickly dropped. Following the campaign, an Austin women's organization had held a party in honor of the wife of the new congressman. She had been able to avoid making a speech at the party, but she could not avoid standing in a receiving line. And while she had shaken hands and chatted with the strangers filing by, she had done it with so obvious an effort that her friends winced inwardly as they watched. The bright smile on her face had been as rigid as if it had been set in stone. At Longley, with so many brilliant raconteurs only too anxious to hold the stage, no such effort was required. She was able to sit for hours just listening, absolutely silent. And of course, often Lady Bird was not at Longley. As 1938 became 1939, and 1939 became 1940, with increasing frequency Lyndon Johnson would arrive alone, having left her back in Washington. Sometimes, in fact, he would have dispatched her to Texas. It was necessary for the Johnson's car, filled with household possessions, to be driven back and forth at the start and finish of each congressional session, and often Johnson had her make the 1,600-mile trip to Austin accompanied by the wife of one of his aides, saying that he had to stay behind in Washington on business. Later he would fly down. "For years," Lady Bird would say, "my idea of being rich was having enough linens and pots and pans to have a set in each place, and not have to lug them back and forth." The attitude of the Longley regulars was, of course, influenced by the attitude her husband displayed toward her. The brusqueness of the orders he gave her, insisting they be instantly obeyed, the short shrift he accorded her in frequent timid comments. Seeing that in her relationship with Lyndon her opinion didn't count, they gave it little consideration themselves. Marsh, in fact, seems to have been in some doubt as to her name. He was constantly referring to her as Lyndon's wife. To Alice's adoring sister and her best friend, moreover, she was an obstacle to Alice's happiness, and when they did discuss her, there was more than a hint of mockery in their voices. Says Alice Hopkins, "Everybody was trying to be nice to her, but she was just out of place." And the attitude of the regulars was influenced also by the attitude she herself displayed. Lady Bird Johnson herself appears to have felt that she was out of place at Longley. Decades later, describing the estate to the author, she said, "My eyes were just out on stems. They would have interesting people from the world of art and literature and politics. It was the closest I ever came to a salon in my life. There was a dinner table with ever so much crystal and silver." She appears to have felt herself that she had little to contribute to the scintillating conversation there. She felt that her host, for example, not only looked like a Roman emperor, but was one of the most fascinating men I have ever met. He knew all sorts of things. He went all over Europe, he went to Salzburg and places like that. He was the first one who introduced Lyndon to the danger of Hitler. I think he saw a Nazi rally. He made my blood run cold. But he also made us see why the German people would be for him, Hitler, that they would be respected and all. She appears, in fact, to have felt keenly the contrast between herself and her hostess. "I remember Alice in a series of long and elegant dresses, and me in, well, much less elegant," she says. In a voice with a trace of heroine worship, she notes that they had known each other slightly years before in Austin when she was a University of Texas undergraduate, and Alice was working in the Capitol. And even then, Lady Bird says, "She was quite an intellectual girl, and you felt destined for more exciting things than being a legislator's secretary." And then, when we saw them again in Washington, she was even prettier and just dressed so beautifully. She was very tall and elegant, really beautiful in a sort of Amazonian way. Once, during a Marsh discourse on the Hitler threat, her admiration for Alice moved her to a rare attempt at a witticism. "Maybe Alice can help us fight him," she said. "She's so tall and blonde, she looks like a Valkyrie," an attempt which was, of course, ignored. Had they been more observant, however, the Longley regulars might have noticed qualities in the drab woman as well as in the elegant one. During the loud arguments to which she sat quietly listening, books would be mentioned. Lady Bird would, on her return to Washington, check those books out of the public library, check them out and read them. Because of Marsh's preoccupation with Hitler, she checked out a copy of Mein Kampf, read it, and learned it. She never attempted to talk about it at Longley, even though when Hitler's theories were discussed thereafter, she was aware that while Marsh knew what he was talking about, no one else in the room did, except her. And she read other books, too. One summer is still remembered by the Longley regulars as the summer that Lady Bird read War and Peace. They snickered at the way she carried the big book with her everywhere, even though by the end of the summer she had finished it, and because she felt there was something to be gained by rereading, had promptly begun at the beginning to read it through again. And there were other qualities, which the regulars note, even though they don't realize the significance of what they are saying. Alice Hopkins, while saying that she was just out of place, says immediately thereafter that if everyone was just trying to be nice to her, she would be nice right back, calm and gracious. She was self-contained. Even Alice's sister noticed that there was something quite remarkable in her self-discipline, the things she made herself do. She was forever working, not only on her reading but on her figure. She had always been dumpy, but now the extra weight came off and stayed off. And some of the Longley regulars even began, after a while, to wonder if there were not still greater depths to the self-discipline of Lady Bird Johnson. Of course Lady Bird must have known of her husband's affair with Alice Glass, Frank Altorf says. Oh, I'm sure she did. Why else, the regulars point out, would she think that her husband was going, without her, on so many weekends to Longley, when, as she could easily have determined, Charles Marsh was not at home? Says Mary Louise, "The thing I could never understand was how she stood it. Lyndon would leave her on weekends, weekend after weekend, just leave her home. I wouldn't have stood it for a minute." But stand it she did. We were all together a lot, Lyndon and Lady Bird and Charles and Alice, Mary Louise says. And Lady Bird never said a word. She showed nothing, nothing at all. The passion eventually faded from Johnson's relationship with Alice Glass. She married Charles Marsh, but quickly divorced him, and married several times thereafter. She never got over Lyndon, Alice Hopkins says. But the relationship itself survived. Even when he was a senator, Lyndon Johnson would still occasionally dismiss his chauffeur for the day and drive his huge limousine the 90 miles to Longley. The friendship was ended only by the Vietnam War, which Alice considered one of history's horrors. By 1967, she referred to Johnson, in a letter she wrote to Oltorff, in bitter terms. And later she told friends that she had burned love letters that Johnson had written her, because she didn't want her granddaughter to know she had ever been associated with the man responsible for Vietnam. Chapter 26. The 10th District. When Johnson ran again, he would not only have financial and press support, but a record as well. Quite a remarkable record. On Saturday, May 15th, 1937, 2 days after he had been sworn in as a congressman, Sherman Birdwell and Carol Keach arrived in Washington, having driven up from Texas. When they pulled up in front of the old House office building, late Saturday afternoon, Johnson was waiting for them on the sidewalk. "Let's go up to the office," he said. "I think we have a lot of mail." Inside the door of his temporary office, room 118 on the first floor, gray sacks of mail, from constituents of a district without representation since Buchanan's death almost 3 months before, were piled high. Although Birdwell and Keach had put in a long day on the road, the three men started working on the mail that night, and worked until well after midnight. Johnson left then, to bunk down with his brother, since the Kennedy Warren apartment wouldn't be vacant until Monday. But he told Birdwell and Keach to sleep at the office. That would make it more convenient for them to resume work early Sunday morning. Keach left in a few days to return to his job with the NYA, but Birdwell stayed on. A newcomer to Washington, he worked 7 days a week, and such long hours that, he recalls, "even though the House office building is just across the street from the Capitol, I was there for over a month before I ever saw the Capitol from the inside." The only reason he got to see it then, he says, was that Mayor Tom Miller telephoned from Austin with an urgent message for Johnson. "I went over there to find him, and that was the first time I was even in the Capitol of the United States." Birdwell's wife, Dale, was recruited to help, without pay. "We just all worked. It was just family," Birdwell says. Gene Latimer, back in Washington at his old full-time job with the Federal Housing Administration, worked for Johnson in the evenings and on weekends, out of his love for Mr. Johnson, Birdwell says. Hard though Johnson's staff had worked when he was a congressional secretary, it had to work harder now. There was much more work than there had been when we were with Clayburgh, because he, Johnson, wanted an organization built overnight, the same type of organization that it had taken him 4 years to build with Clayburgh, Latimer says. Birdwell, who hadn't worked in Clayburgh's office, had thought at first that the workload would ease when the backlog of letters was eliminated. But when they had caught up, the load seemed to get heavier. The mail, Birdwell saw, was the best way to make people feel they had a close personal relationship, a close personal rapport with their congressman. So if there wasn't enough mail, we had to generate mail. No matter how hard they worked, Birdwell was to say, "We never did get caught up," and he came to realize they never would. Johnson seemed unable to meet the demands he was making on himself. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.